Well, thank you so much. It is so nice you guys to come out in this cold. I guess our original location was covered in snow, the road, and you couldn't get in. And that you were able to venture over here, I really appreciate. And we have been having a great day. It all started last night when we had Minnesota has early voting because we're a Super Tuesday state. So we had this rally at First Avenue in the middle of a blizzard just as bad as this one. In fact, worse, I think. And then I had to make a decision. I said, okay, we'll drive really slowly. We drove down to Des Moines, and it took like 6 hours, almost five and a half. We got there at 2 in the morning. And so here we are. And then we spoke to the teachers this morning, and have worked our way here to Clinton. And it's exciting to be back. As I mentioned, I actually was a speaker at the Democratic dinner here a few years ago. And I remember it was a potluck. Is that right? Yeah. And there was some good food. Yeah, or something. It was for Hillary. And Jim Webb also spoke. Yeah. I was the surrogate. Yeah. And Andy McGuire was there. That's right. And Andy's my campaign chair. So, all right. Okay. Well, we won't take another trip down memory lane. But with us today, I understand, in addition to Jim, thank you for that introduction, Carol McGuire is here, the Clinton County Democratic Vice Chair, right? Is she here? Somewhere right there. Thank you. And Bill Jacobs is here, your chair right there. Thank you, Bill. Gene Pardee, chair of the 2nd Congressional. Where are you? Right there. Thank you. It's you. And then as well, I wanted to mention my organizers here, Eli and Emily. Where are you guys? Thank you for your good work. So it has been a journey. I think you all know that I've got something going on in Washington right now, as in the impeachment hearing, and I think you all know how important that is. And I first will say two things about this. One, I'm a mom, so I can do two things at once. And secondly, I think you know how important this is. This is my constitutional duty to be there. There are only 100 jurors, and I am one of them. And in many ways, we represent all of you when we're the jury. And I truly believe that the voters in the early states, which of course includes Iowa and South Carolina and Nevada and New Hampshire, will understand. And whether we are Skyping in or whether we're doing teletown halls or whether I've got my husband here or my daughter who is currently in Concord, New Hampshire, and she is there and told me she got a standing ovation. I said, oh, that's so great, honey. She goes, Mom, they were standing from the beginning. So that is what we're going to do. And so this is a big opportunity for me because we may not have many other times that we're going to be back. Sundays for sure. And then hopefully there'll be some other times where people are, you know, there's a break in the trial. And I think you know what the big issue there right now is, whether or not we're going to have witnesses. When you go back through history, we have never had an administration that has closed off witnesses, closed off documents. The documents that were used by the House or have come out actually have all been voluntary from people who just couldn't stand it anymore, and also from FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests. This administration has really produced zero witnesses and zero documents. And right in the articles of impeachment, it explains in the part about abusing the process of Congress, obstructing the process with Congress, that this has never happened in American history. So I don't think you're surprised, but that is what we're dealing with right now. And you have a number of witnesses, including John Bolton, who says that he actually wants to testify. We're simply trying to get our Republican colleagues to do their jobs. And as I said at the debate here in Iowa, otherwise we should just hand the president a crown and a scepter, because they may as well make him king. And in our country, we have always believed, in fact, our country was founded on this idea that we didn't want to be reporting to a king, that we wanted to have a democracy. And that is really the big debate. And when I look at that impeachment hearing, I see the immediacy of that proceeding. But I think that the issues and the conduct that we're going to be discussing really goes out in a much bigger way. It's about a president that puts his private interests, his partisan interests, in front of the interests of this country. And while I may be the juror in that proceeding, you are a juror for something even bigger, and that is this election. And when you step back and look at the election that way, for this moment in time like no other, you see the importance of your jobs as well. And I think we all know that this is an economic check on this president, and that there is not shared prosperity. We have everything from growing income inequality to no help with people for people to afford their health care or their pharmaceuticals, to really no plan at all to make it easier to go to college, no long-term care plan, something I brought up on the debate stage, the problems with the rural economy and his farm policy and those waivers to the big oil companies. All of that is a economic check with this vote. But I think we do ourselves short if we don't always see something else. And that is for many people out there, maybe people who didn't vote in the last election, or for some moderate Republicans, independents. I know this county is such a unique county, and because Barack, in many ways, it's a unique county. But it is one of those 31 counties in Iowa that went for Barack Obama and then went for Donald Trump. In your county, I don't know how many other counties have that margin, that went 20 points, my staff told me, for Barack Obama. We should check and make sure that's right, because I look shocked. But I think it went for a lot for Barack Obama. And then it went something like 5 points for Donald Trump. And so talk about a place where we could make up ground. And so when I think about some of the voters in our country right now, I think about some people in our own party that stayed home in 2016. And then I think about a group of people who maybe do not agree with everything we say on that debate stage. I do not agree with everything that's said on the debate stage. But what we agree on is this, that we as America have a heart bigger than that guy in the White House, that our country has ideals and hopes and dreams bigger than any of his mean tweets. And that is really at its core when you look at this election for some people who may not agree with everything we say. It is a patriotism check for them. It's a decency check. It's a values check. And it is that moment when he was standing with Vladimir Putin, that ruthless dictator, and a reporter asked him, well, what about Russia interfering in the election? And this is at the G20 on the world stage. And he made a joke to Vladimir Putin about it. Think about the hundreds of thousands of Americans who have lost their lives on the battlefield standing up for democracies, our democracies and democracies around the world. That's what World War II was about. Thousands of Iowans lost their lives standing up for democracies. Think about those four little girls at the height of the civil rights movement who lost their lives in that church in Birmingham, Alabama. Innocence. Innocence. In that fight for civil rights, where people were trying to hold on to that democracy and expand it to others, and other people were trying to push back. So much of the great moments in our history have been, and the worst moments, have been about fights over democracy and the Constitution. I mean, we are in Martin Luther King weekend, and I'm going to be at some events here on that day, as well as in South Carolina. And you think about what Martin Luther King once said. He said that we are all tied in a single garment of destiny. And what affects one directly affects all of us indirectly. So when you think of this decency check, when Donald Trump goes after immigrants or goes after people of color, it affects one person or a group of people directly, but it really affects all of us in our democracy indirectly. Decency check. Examples of this for me is a guy, this is the first time I sort of understood this. He is a cattle rancher in Minnesota, and he was taking me a tour of his cattle ranch, and we were going in and out of these big cows on this ATV, and I thought, what a way to die. And then he takes me inside his house, and we're in the house, and everyone's gone, and he says, you know, we voted for Trump. And I said, what do you mean we, the ranchers, your family? And he said, no, we, I mean, I did. He said, I don't like to talk about myself. And so I say we. And he said, we voted for him because we were mad about health care. And then he said, but then I saw him standing in front of the wall. And I said, well, the wall really hasn't been built. And he said, no, 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 the CIA wall. The day after the inauguration, the day of the Women's March, actually, which is happening today, that day, Donald Trump, I remember seeing it on TV and being in shock, the sacred wall of anonymous CIA agents who have lost their lives in the line of duty. And no one knows their names, but there's this wall with a star for each one of them. And he picked that place to give a highly partisan speech about the size of his crowd the day after his inauguration. But that guy, that bugged that guy a lot. And then he said, then the Boy Scout rally. And he was a Boy Scout, so he said that when Trump gave that speech to all those young people, that partisan political speech, by the way, my husband is a Boy Scout. He's one of six boys, and his parents had four boys. They wanted to have a girl, and so his mom got pregnant again and had identical twin boys. And they lived in a trailer court, actually, in a single trailer home with triple bunk beds. And five of the six boys became Eagle Scouts. And I never say which one didn't make it because I don't want to embarrass my husband. But so I understood when this guy talked about this, he had a tear went down his cheek. And he said that, you know, that was it for me. He said, when he did that, I decided it just wasn't patriotic. Then a guy in New Hampshire I meet, we're in a long line of voters, are all wearing these little happy stickers that say, I am a climate change voter, I'm a Supreme Court voter, I'm a reproductive rights voter. And this guy comes by in a brown jacket, he doesn't have any sticker on. And I said, sir, you don't have a sticker on. And he says, that's because I was a Trump voter. And these are my neighbors, and they don't know. And I don't, so don't say anything. And he said, but I'm not doing it again. So I just want us to remember, particularly in this county, where you know people that maybe believe some of his promises that he made, and you can be the best frontline ambassadors when it comes to some of this. And I'll get into some of the arguments that we have. But we have to remember there are people that are voting on that. They really are. And that's a good thing. They are voting for that because they believe in our country. And so my first piece of profound advice as you look at what the landscape and what you're doing in the next few weeks is we better not screw this up. Because we have been winning. We won with Abby and Cindy, right? And I'm telling you, if we put the right candidate at the top, we will win with JD. We will win the Senate seat. And I'm not just saying that. Look at what just happened. Just look at what happened in 2018, those congressional races in Iowa. But we won the governor's race in the state of Kansas with Laura Kelly. We won in Michigan with Gretchen Whitmer. And my favorite four words in politics, former Governor Scott Walker. We won. So we can win statewide with the right candidates. They're not celebrities, but they fit the states. Look what just happened last month. Kentucky. Louisiana re-elect a Democratic governor. Kentucky elect a Democratic governor. So Mitch McConnell now has a Democratic governor. What do those two states have in common? Well, one thing, they're more redder than Iowa. They're more red than Iowa, so don't tell me we can't win Iowa statewide. But the second thing is the night before those Democratic governors won, who went down there to campaign for their opponents? Donald Trump. So my question is, where can we send him next? That happened. So that is the actual empirical evidence that this is going on. So we want to bring people with us. Second, how do we define him and talk about him when we're dealing with some of our people in the middle of the country? I went on this blue wall tour, I called it that, to Western Pennsylvania, met with the carpenters, met with the dock workers in Michigan, and met with the dairy farmers in Wisconsin. And I went to Ohio, of course, Iowa, and Minnesota, where Hillary had the lowest percentage of any state that she won. And Donald Trump has come back to our state, as you know, multiple times. And so my first plan is to build a beautiful blue wall of Democratic votes around those states and make Donald Trump pay for it. The second thing is to listen to them. And yeah, some of them think of him as a bully like we do and a racist and the rest. But a lot of times when they think of him, they think of the fact that he made a bunch of promises that he was going to bring prescription drug prices down. That hasn't happened. He promised them that he was going to stand up for the rural economy. And then we have stories like I told on the debate stage about the biodiesel plant in Crawfordsville that went under. He promised them he was going to build infrastructure, and we still have so many areas of the country where levees are breaking, like you've seen in Iowa, to a lack of rural broadband, to a lack of improvements to the infrastructure for our schools. So they know that these promises haven't been kept to them. They've been kept to his friends, as he said after he signed the tax bill and went down to Mar-a-Lago. This is my favorite line, where he said to his friends, "You just got a lot richer." Were any of you there? I just didn't want to embarrass anyone, you know, if they were in the room. But so that's the point, is that you have to, people know that this prosperity hasn't been shared. Part of that is that they also know that when things go wrong in their lives, if the insulin costs are too high, or their kid has college costs they didn't expect, or they can't pay their mortgage, they just have to figure out some way to get by, take out a loan, get an extra job. Their spouse has to get an extra job. But what does this guy do when things go wrong? Most of them of his own making. He whines. He complains. He blames other people. And the way they think of it, he's got the best job in the world. He's living in that nice house. Over the course of his life, his dad gave him $413 million. And by the way, I can't wait to debate him on the debate stage, because I'm going to be able to say, that was your family trust. Me, my grandpa worked 1,500 feet underground in the mines up in northern Minnesota, the iron ore mines. He couldn't even graduate from high school because he was the oldest boy and had to raise his 9 brothers and sisters when his parents died. And then he and my grandma saved money in a coffee can in the basement to send my dad to a 2-year community college. $413 million does not fit in a coffee can. That is my family's trust. And when you are given opportunities like I was because of my grandpa and my grandma, you do not go into the world with a sense of entitlement. When you are given opportunities because of a coworker or a friend or your grandparents or your parents or a teacher, you go into the world with a sense of obligation. An obligation to lift people up instead of shoving them down. An obligation to lift people up instead of hoarding it for yourself. That is the case to be made against this guy. And when he blames people, it is sometimes quite ridiculous. Some of my favorite top 4, he blames Barack Obama. He does that all the time. He blames the head of the Federal Reserve, who he appointed, who was just trying to do his job. He blames the city of Baltimore. That was an all-time low when little kids had to wake up and see the President of the United States call their city, kids in Baltimore, rat-infested. Or my personal favorite, he blames the entire country of Denmark. Who does that? That's what he does. He goes to the NATO conference, and some of the leaders are caught on videotape making fun of him. I've heard senators make worse fun of other senators, even when they like them. It wasn't that big a deal. But what does he do? He is so thin-skinned. He is such a whiner. He leaves. He quits on us. He quits on America. The job wasn't done there. He quits. And America doesn't quit. It is a different way of thinking about him through the eyes of people who actually thought he was going to do something for them. And I think that is a really important case to make. Third thing, optimistic economic agenda. Somehow in 2016, despite all the good work Hillary did, some of that got lost. Part of it was no one had ever run against someone like Donald Trump. And it was easy to go down rabbit holes with him. We all did it. And part of this is keeping focused on an optimistic economic agenda for this country. That means things like doing something about health care. While he tries to kick people off their health care when they have pre-existing conditions, we must have a plan to bring premiums down and to go after pharmaceutical prices. I think you've heard enough on the debate stage about this to know my view. I know some of my colleagues are well-intentioned, but as I said the other day, we have a situation where 2/3 of the Democrats in the Senate are not on the Medicare for All bill. A bunch of the new Congress people that got elected and put Nancy Pelosi in as Speaker, they are not for that bill. And so to me, that debate isn't really real. And we have had it a lot. Even if you believe that's what we should do, we have had that debate over and over again. When I actually think we need to be thinking bigger than that debate. And when I say bigger, I mean tackling these big problems in front of us. One of them is the bringing the premiums down. And I think the best way to do that is with the nonprofit public option, which I've long supported. Secondly, taking on pharma prices. I lead most of the bills in this area. I've been taking on pharma since I got to the Senate. That means unleashing the power of 43 million Americans, seniors, to negotiate prices under Medicare. And when you hear that, all that gobbledygook, understand, pharmaceutical companies got a provision baked into law that says that Medicare can't negotiate for cheaper prices. Medicaid can, VA can, but Medicare can't. That is exactly what happened. So I have carried the bill. I have 34 senators on it to lift that ban. And as president, I can get it done. Other examples. We had Bernie and I actually did a bill together, and that I now have the bill with Grassley. What an interesting thing that is. But it shows you how we can get it done, and that is to bring in less expensive drugs from other countries like Canada. Our amendment, Bernie and my amendment, came up at about midnight one night, and 14 Republicans voted for it. I think they were too tired, but they did vote for it. And I do believe the votes are out there, and that would be a big competition to bring prices down. There's a great bill over in the House that puts a cap on drugs, and that would save $350 billion for taxpayers in 10 years, to give you a sense. And the cap is tied to the international average for the drugs because they're charging too much here. Okay, that's a whole group of things that I think there's big agreement on. It's nearly 20% of our health care costs when you include hospital pharmacists. Secondly, mental health and addiction. For me, this is personal. I was the first candidate to come out with a big policy on this. My dad, when I was growing up, struggled with alcoholism. By the time I got married, he had 3 DWIs, and the judge said to him at that moment, "Oh, you got to pick. It's going to be treatment or jail." And he picked treatment, and it saved his life. In his words, he was pursued by grace. And it was the faith. It was the family. It was his treatment. And he has now been sober. He's 91 years old ever since that time. His AA group still visits him at the assisted living. And in his words, it would be hard to get a drink around here anyway. And that, I saw that with my own eyes. And so, as you know, there's an opioid epidemic everywhere in the country, but there's still problems with meth and with crack cocaine, with alcoholism, and that's why my take that money, we're going to get in such a lot of money with the settlement with the opioid companies. And we need to make sure that the money goes, and a president can do this with a master settlement to where people need the help. It also should include mental health. 1 in 5 Americans struggle with mental health sometime in their life. You only have 64 public mental health beds in the entire state of Iowa. I was in Wapello and met with a group of people, kind of like this. And this one woman had just got off work. She was a counselor at the high school, school with 650 kids. And she said that day alone, 4 kids had come up to her with thoughts of suicide. And she said they were all immigrant kids. And their parents worked at the plant, and they were all afraid that their whole life was going to be taken away from them anyway, that their family was going to be deported. That's a bad policy, of course, but that's also about mental health and making sure we have counselors in the schools and we have enough mental health beds. So that's something that we really aren't tackling. Last thing I'd mention is long-term care, the elephant that doesn't fit in this room. We're seeing a doubling of our senior population, and yet we haven't made any adjustments to our laws about how we're going to make this easier and for funding. Keeping Social Security strong, keeping Medicaid strong, those are the obvious ones. But I do more. I think we should also create incentives for people to get long-term care insurance, for people to stay in their homes if they want and have home health care. Example, we're going to have 1 million openings for home health care workers in the next 10 years that we have no idea how to fill. That's why when we had, if anyone watched the debate, we had a little back and forth about education. And I said, you know, I want to even think bigger than you guys. I want to think of a plan and have a plan where our education system matches our jobs. Right now, we know we're going to have over 1 million openings for home health care workers, over 100,000 openings for nursing assistants, over 70,000 openings for electricians. We are not going to have a shortage of MBAs. We're going to have a shortage of plumbers. And so what we need to do is think about, what degrees do you need? We're going to need a lot more four-year degrees, but we're also going to need a lot of one- and two-year degrees. And we're going to need to pay home health care workers a livable wage and make that affordable, or people aren't going to go into those areas. Other piece about this is creating help, and I found a way to pay for this as well, for people to afford home health care and afford being in assisted living before they reach Medicaid. My own story, my dad... he somehow bought long-term care insurance. I do not know why, but he did. And that's what's keeping him in this house with 15 other seniors right now where he's really happy. Well, I know exactly when that health insurance is going to run out. It's like in about a year and a half or 2 years. Then we go into his savings. It's not that much. He was married 3 times. Whole nother story. But that is that. Then he goes on Medicaid, and I've already talked to Catholic Elder Care, and they said they'd take him in, but he can't stay where he is because they don't take Medicaid. Our story is actually a good story compared to so many other families who have to go right to Medicaid or go through their savings more quickly. And so I think making it easier to get long-term care would not just be good for our seniors. It's good for the people who have kids themselves and are trying to help pay for their aging parents or take care of it. It really affects our whole society. Other challenges. I mentioned the workforce training, and I'll keep it with that, but it's just making it easier to go to college by doubling Pell Grants and extending the income level and then making free 1 and 2 year degrees and making it easier to pay back loans. The next thing, immigration reform, remembering that immigrants don't diminish America. They are America. We need workers right now in our healthcare fields, in our factories, starting small businesses. 70 of our Fortune 500 companies are headed up by people from other countries. 25% of our U.S. Nobel laureates throughout history were born in other countries. Immigrants don't diminish America. They are America. And so the idea here is to look at that bill that we passed in 2013 that would have been ready for this one. It would have brought the debt down by deficit down by $158 billion in 10 years because people come out of the shadows and they pay taxes. The AFL-CIO supported it. The Chamber of Commerce supported it. The migrant workers supported it. And the Farmers Union and the Farm Bureau supported it. Where did it end up? It passed the Senate. Grassley actually voted for it. Most of the Democrats, I think all of them, voted for it. Where does it end up? It ends up in John Boehner's freezer next to the frozen peas. Well, Nancy Pelosi now has that freezer, okay? And she wants to pass it. So all this is about is making sure that we get a president that wants to get it done and maybe flip the Senate, which we can do. I'll get to that at the end. Other challenges, climate change, existential crisis of our time, getting back into the International Climate Change Agreement, bringing back the clean power rules, understanding that we may make these changes and we put a price on carbon, that we want to make sure that the money that comes in from that goes directly to people. So it goes to people who want help affording their health care. So it goes directly to people, I'm sorry, the number, I mean their energy bills. So it goes directly to people that need a job because we've made changes with our economy as we go to more clean energy jobs. I think you know in Iowa, you already are what you call the Saudi Arabia of wind. That's what North Dakota says too. But you could do even more. And so that was what will create those incentives by putting a price on carbon. But we must make sure, and I think the best candidate to do this, honestly, someone from the Midwest that can make the Midwest case. We know what's happening on the coast. The votes have been on the coasts. But we have to make this airtight so people know they're going to get the money back. Otherwise, we're not going to get the political support to get it done. Rural-urban divide, one of my big obsessions. I grew up in the suburbs, but very close to farms. My best friends all had relatives that had farms. We would go out to the dairy farms and milk cows. And I then get to the U.S. Senate, and I keep hearing about this rural-urban divide. And I've worked really hard on the rural issues. My number one committee to get on was the Agriculture Committee. I have been on there. I'm the only one on that debate stage. that has served on the Agriculture Committee and asked to be on that. And you all know it's not just the Farm Bill. It's also economic development and rural issues. I've been a leader, the Democratic leader, on biofuels and making sure that we don't let the oil companies get away with murder, which is kind of what they're doing with the Trump administration, with these waivers to big oil companies, and that we have a safety net in place for our farmers. So those are some of the challenges that I see, and I want to save some of this for questions. But what I want you to know is that I am the candidate who is on the surge, as they say. I got actually a text message from a friend of mine, and she said, congratulations on your insurgency. It was a bad autocorrect. We have been going up everywhere. We have doubled our field offices. We just had a poll yesterday, a public poll, Emerson poll in New Hampshire, where I am at 10 points, only 4 points from some of the leading candidates in this race, including the vice president. And so we are moving up. And I'm so proud of the support that I have in Iowa. I have the endorsements of more elected legislators and former elected legislators than anyone else in the race. And that's going to be really helpful for me on caucus night and in these next 2 weeks, given that I will be in Washington in the middle of this trial. And so I guess I would end with that and just let you know there's a reason I picked the color green for our buttons, and that is because one of my mentors in politics was Paul Wellstone, and that was his color, and he was Tom Harkin's best friend in the U.S. Senate. And the last year of Paul's life, before it was so quickly taken, sadly, tragically taken from him, when he was in that plane crash and lost Sheila, his wife, he died, their daughter. That year, I was with him a lot because I had no opponent. I was up for reelection, sounds nice, for county attorney, and I was with him a lot. And what I saw that year was an amazing thing. To witness, and that was that he took the courageous vote against the Iraq War. He was the only Democrat in a tough seat to do that, and he was still going to win. He was ahead before he died. The other thing that I saw was that he had told the state he had MS, and his whole MO was that he would run really fast in these parades, and he couldn't do that anymore. And his whole thing was that he would talk really, really fast in his ads because his opponents had more money than him, and so he had to talk really fast because he only had 30 seconds. And so that year, he couldn't run really fast, and yet he would stand on the back of his green bus in the parades with Sheila at his side, and they would wave. But what was so amazing to see was that they had motivated so many people in these green shirts to run around that bus that you didn't even notice he wasn't running himself. That's what he did. And I'm asking you to do that for me. I know I am not the candidate with the most name ID, but I'm the one that's gaining the most name ID. I'm not the one that's buying the $10 million Super Bowl ad. He's not here. I am going to make up, those ads don't vote. And I'm going to make up for that by just with people. And we need your help. We have, as I said, incredible. Look at how happy they are. And we would love for you to sign the commit to caucus cards. My favorite story of getting someone support in Iowa was I had breakfast with Kay, the former mayor of Cedar Rapids. And at the very end of it, she says, I got some great news for you. And I go, really? What is it, Kay? She said, I'm 78% with you. She got to 100%. And so that is our campaign. And I would just really, your support would mean so much, mostly because I'm going to need people running around that bus for me. So with that, let's take some questions. And thank you so much for being here in the middle of the cold. All right. Very good. Okay, this looks good. Shaw from Clinton. Is that Sean? Sean, do you want to, where are you, Sean? Do you want me to read it or do you want to say it? Oh, okay. My wife, only 55 years old, has had Alzheimer's for 5 years. Oh, that's so hard. I know you have the disease in your family. That's why my dad's in the assisted living. He got it later, though, and this is so much harder. He got it in his late 80s. I took early retirement to care for her. Will my retirement last? I don't know. What do you do to help people with Alzheimer's? Thank you for sharing that. So, as you know, you are not alone. By 2050, 14 million Americans are going to have Alzheimer's. It is the most expensive disease, as you know, in our country. By the way, it takes its toll, and by the caregiving needs. So the first thing, of course, is to devote ourselves to research and a cure. They are getting more and more information. Mayo in Minnesota has done a lot on this, and I've visited their labs, and a lot has come out of the precision medicine and drawing of the genes, and they've learned more and more. But one of the things they've learned is when they find out about it earlier, they can then track it and figure out what we can do to make it better. So there's all kinds of things going on, which isn't going to fix or solve your wife's problem right now. But that's one of them. And the second thing is caretaking. It takes its toll. And that's why I actually have, as part of my plan, a $6,000 tax credit for family caregivers and others that are really sacrificing. Otherwise, the government would be paying for it. And so we should be rewarding people that are willing to do that caregiving as well as other caregiving. The third thing is education. The Alzheimer's Association is doing more and more in small towns and big towns, just getting people to understand that work at stores and work in cafes and say, okay, this is what might happen if someone has early stage Alzheimer's. They're going to be part of our community. They're going to be walking around. They may forget things, and this is how you should act. And it's been actually an amazing community building. And I've met with a lot of people in my own state. I go to all my counties, 87 counties every year. Of course, that doesn't match the 99 counties that I've done in Iowa. But I've done many meetings with the Alzheimer's Association, and that's been an amazing thing. For me, actually, we go to those meetings as a senator, but also as a daughter of someone who's struggling with it. It almost is like a little counseling group you go to, as I would listen to everyone and their what's happening to them in their lives. And I think a lot of this, of course, Affordable Care Act protects people from getting kicked off of their insurance for pre-existing condition, especially if people are too young to qualify for Medicare, doing more to make that less expensive, and then all of this long-term care that I already talked about. So anyway, thank you for doing that. Really, really tough thing. Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you. Well, I think one of the things about having a life that isn't, you know, everything I went through with my dad, parents divorced, those like things, I think it makes you such a better elected official because you actually understand real problems. I also think, I was telling this to a reporter this morning, I also think having not a perfect life and not everything given to you on a silver spoon, I think it makes you understand that the extremes don't always work. In my case, like with my dad, if he screwed up and I'd have to take the car keys away from him or something like that, if for me that was, oh, that's bad, I can't love you anymore, you can't be like that. You start to see the gray more in the world. And I think that makes you a better leader because you can find compromise and you can think of things like someone isn't evil just because you don't agree with them on one thing or they messed up in their life. And I think it's a really important thing. I've been reading this Doris Kearns Goodwin's book that she just did on leadership, and she just took a bunch of presidents. And the number one thing she thinks that seems to connect them, even though they have all different backgrounds, is resilience. It's not really how they're doing when things are good. It's how they're doing when things are bad. All right. Thank you. Let's see. Jesse? Where are you, Jesse? Where? Oh, do you want to ask it yourself? Okay. Okay. As president, this is why I do the written questions, because some people might not want to raise their hand, and then you can. It really works well. As president, could you raise the federal minimum wage to at least $15 an hour? What would you do about affordable child care for those who can't afford it? Two really good questions. I have long supported the fight for 15 and going to $15 an hour. When we talk about these things of how we're going to get home health care workers, things like that, we have to raise the federal minimum wage. It has not, and you would phase it in rural areas, all of that, but it hasn't been raised since I first got to the Senate, something like almost a decade, and we haven't raised it, and it would help everyone. Affordable child care. So there's a really good plan that a lot of the Democrats support. It's a bill by a woman named Patty Murray, who's the U.S. Senator from Washington State. And what it does is it says if you are at up to 150% of the median income, which is fairly good, you know, it's, maybe you are not there yet, so that this would help you. You should never have more than 7% of your child care expenses be child care expenses, and that the government will make up the difference. So it's really kind of matching funds depending on your needs to help you pay for child care. And my view is, given the child care deserts that we see in Iowa, areas where there's not even child care available, if you start putting in subsidies, and of course it would be even more subsidies if you have less money, if you start doing that, that's going to create more of a flow of money so that there will be more child cares because they're going to know that there's a place to put them. Iowa has one of the highest numbers of people working, women working actually in the country, and you just have a lot of needs for child care that aren't being met. So, yes? Okay, all right. Okay, let's see. Okay. Okay, where is Charlie? Right there. Do you want to ask it? Good. You guys are hilarious. Okay, I will ask it. Is the new trade agreement with China worth what we are paying for it? Okay, that's interesting. I would not have taken the approach that Donald Trump did to trade. He used a meat cleaver, or maybe we should say a tweet cleaver, and got us into this position where at one point he was going to put tariffs on $300 billion of goods, and then it literally 2 weeks later or 1 week later, he goes, oh, no, half that. And one thing you learn from trade negotiations is you should keep your promises and keep your threats, and he has done neither. And the Chinese are in it for the long haul. They are watching this, and they're watching everything that he does. And one of the issues is, you know, fine, get an interim agreement going, but there's still a bunch of problems out there. And the other problem, when you say, is it worth it, and I think you know this, a lot of these soybean contracts have already been let out to farmers in other countries, longer-term contracts. So it is going to be very hard to get back to what was normal. And we are already having some problems with commodity prices for both corn and soybeans, and then he comes in with his, you know, brilliant trade strategy. So I think that was sarcastic. I think that it is going to be very hard to get back there. Now, let me give you my philosophy here, is that trade can be a good thing, but it has to be fair trade. Over 90% of our customers, potential customers, are outside of our borders of our country. And I have voted for some trade agreements and voted against other ones. I voted for the one last week, the USMCA, which I'll get to in a minute. So I think the philosophy should be to do what's best for America. And part of that is not just the words in the agreement, but are you really going to enforce the agreement? And I actually led an effort in our state when we saw a bunch of steel dumping by China on our shores, and a bunch of the iron ore mines had to close down. And so I brought up Obama's chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, to northern Minnesota and met with the workers up there, and a huge room of a long table this long of the workers, the mine owners, the elected officials. And I remember at one point at this meeting, because a bunch of them had been closed down, this guy named Dan Hill, who is a young guy and active in the Steelworkers Union, and he looks across to McDonough way at the other end of the table, and everyone else had talked, and he said, you know, my son just graduated from preschool, and all the kids were asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And some of the kids said, I want to be a firefighter, I want to be a doctor. And he said, my boy said, I want to be an iron ore miner like my daddy. And so then Dan Hill had this Steelworkers t-shirt, and he put it in this ball, and he threw it to Obama's chief of staff, McDonough, who used to be a big football player in Minnesota. And I'm thinking, catch it, catch it. And he catches the t-shirt. And he went back to Washington, and we did some work, Sherrod Brown and I and a few other people, passed some bills, but mostly we upped the enforcement. And what happened when we upped the enforcement and started putting on some very sort of targeted tariffs and things, not the kind Trump has done, but targeted things, they opened the mines again. It changed the whole pricing structure. And that Dan Hill went back to work, and so did a whole lot of other people, and they actually expanded it. So it's hard work. I remember I went to the Commerce Department, to the bowels of the Commerce Department, and met with the 150 people that work on trade enforcement. You have no idea how it's all these. They're filing all these cases, right, about and crunching all those numbers, and they're economists to prove that something isn't fair. And I brought them petitzas, which is a Slovenian dessert that they serve up in northern Minnesota that my grandma used to make. And I brought it to them because that's what the workers, it's an area where they have a lot of Slovenian, people of Slovenian descent. And I brought it to them and met with them for about an hour and a half and listened to what they did. And no senator had ever gone to meet with them. So I don't want us to forget those workers in the basement that really to do the job on trade policy means making sure that things are enforced and that we're smart about how we do it. One little side note on the petitza. Harkin is half Slovenian. Just talked to him last week. And he once came to my Thursday breakfast that I have for constituents, and I serve that. He liked it, and he decided, because he's half Slovenian, that he'd go back to Iowa and buy some. And then he realized no one made it in Iowa. So then I gave him the name of the baker in northern Minnesota, and he called. There were a number of bakeries, and he called this one of them, and this woman, and he says, this is Senator Tom Harkin, and I'd like to order 100 petitzas, one for every member of the U.S. Senate for Christmas. And she says, if you know northern Minnesota, that's kind of a, you know, these are my relatives, tough, blunt place. She goes, it's Christmas, and we're booked. And he says, I don't know if you know who I am. I'm a senator from Iowa, and I chair the Agriculture and Forestry. It's a big forestry committee of the U.S. Senate. She says, I know exactly who you are, but we do not have the petitzas. So then I found him another baker, and he bought the 100 petitzas, and he gave one. But back to the trade policy, we should make things in America. Because when we make things, every time you have an American made good, you are literally holding the hopes and dreams of our workers in your hands. It means quality. It means equality. That is what should be so fundamental to all of our policies. So I actually voted for that USMCA because it had been so greatly improved over the last one, especially with regard to labor inspections at the plants. That's why the head of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, supported it, and why Sherrod Brown, who never voted for a trade agreement, supported it. And it got pretty overwhelming vote in the U.S. Senate, but it's going to set some new standards, and we can always improve it for some of the new trade agreements going forward. And I also looked at it. I said this at the debate, is if we're going to deal with China, we better have some trading block with our neighbors here in North America, because otherwise it's going to be, and that's Canada and Mexico. Otherwise, it's going to be really hard for us to compete. I don't think it's bad that he negotiated. I just think that we made it better, and I voted for the agreement. I'm saying that it is good that he negotiated an agreement. I didn't like everything about it. It got improved some. It was a compromise. People worked together, and that's good. And my role in it was I head up the Canadian-American Interparliamentarian Group, something I have not said on the debate stage because it would take up my whole 30 seconds. And I have done that for a long time. And so after it kind of blew up after the G7 and Canada was getting taken out of it by the administration, I actually went up there with two Republicans. And then I hosted a, well, the Canadians hosted it by put together a dinner, was my idea, of 15 senators, half Democrats, half Republicans, with people like Senator Durbin and Senator Portman. And we went over there and negotiated some of the Canadian issues. And one of my favorite memories from that dinner is, because the Canadians were like, we're, you know, kind of having a little go back and forth about what we need to do to get them back in the agreement. And I told the story of how I had been up in Canada about a month before, and they had taken us to this decommissioned nuclear bunker, whole nother story. I thought they were going to leave us in there because they were so mad. And we get in this bus, and we're leaving, and this really, like expensive sports car, like a Ferrari or something, goes by. And one of the big issues with the trade negotiations with the Canadian dairy that they were getting to, right? And so we're drive by, and this Canadian member of parliament looks out, and he sees the Ferrari drive by, and he goes, oh, a Canadian dairy farmer. So I said, I think that you have acknowledged there's some issues. But anyway, they are our friends. They are the only embassy, by the way, who had signs that said friends, something like friends, allies, partners, in the whole Washington. And I think it was really important to get them back in. And that's about, I didn't like deal with the White House on it, but I dealt through some of my Republican colleagues. So we were able to get that, and we got it done. But I would not have voted for it without the changes that were made. I just bring that up because it's an example of some changes that are being made to trade negotiations that are good. Okay, one last. Well, there's more in here, but I'll take this one. Okay. Oh, this is the same. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is a little different. Dan, where are you? Dan Anderson? Yeah. Touched on some of it. Go Democrat. Yeah, you could say it out loud. And I think, no, I know what you mean. I think it has been frustrating because, but we've seen change. I remember when I first ran for Senate in 2006, and I've always won in the rural areas. I've won in that district big time facing Iowa, the one across from Steve King, the Minnesota First, every single time. I won that county every single time. There you go. Yeah. And then the district that borders North and South Dakota, I've won big time every single time. Northern Minnesota, I've won. And so I think we can win those voters if we have the right candidate who's willing to work on these ag issues and willing to really... I know, and they have to... I think they know that, so... I think that the long term, one of the things you focused on in the question was just, which I already answered, you're right, the tariffs. Although I will say you, in the Senate, we always say everything's been said, but I haven't said it. So thank you for your humbleness. But the second thing is just those waivers they've given to the oil companies. They're supposed to be for small refineries. It's usually been 5-6 a year. And he brought that up decibels to like 70-80 of them. And including to big companies like Chevron and Exxon. So it basically says, oh, you don't have to meet the renewable fuel standard. And when he did that, it really cut right into the renewable fuel standard. Then he went to Council Bluffs, and Cindy Axne and I went there a few months after he did. And he went there and he said, oh, I'm going to fix all this. And then he did 31 more waivers. And now he's sort of come up with a Band-Aid thing that isn't going to fix it. I think people know what's going on, and then they should also be concerned, as you point out in your question, the USDA money that went there. It's good to get the money. The farmers need the money. I supported giving the money, but at some point it's going to have a backlash because they would rather produce goods and sell them, and then people are going to start looking at all this money, and we're much better off having a real strong farm economy than what's happened. And I hear that time and time again. So... getting back to an 06 when I ran, there were some farm issues, but a lot of it was about the war. People were tired, remember, of the Iraq War. and they wanted to bring our soldiers home, and an overwhelming number of people who serve come from rural areas. So I would have Republican voters come up with me. It was an issue in my election, and because my Republican opponent was for the war. And I had people coming up to me saying my neighbor was killed or my son is over there now, and telling me stories about what happened. And they would say, basically, I'm a Republican, or I don't agree with you on such and such issue. You can kind of guess which issues. And they said, but I went to church and I thought about it, and I'm voting for you because I know you share my view. So I think you can have a lot of those things happen in rural areas. It kind of gets back to the decency check. It gets back to the values check, to the patriotism check that I led with. But we better not screw this up, because we have people that are on the cusp of being with us or are with us and want to be with us. And that's why having a candidate that actually can bring people in instead of shutting them out. As I've said over and over again, if you are tired of the extremes in our politics and the nonsense and the noise, you have a home with me. And I think that is the winning message for a lot of people out there. I'm also not as concerned as some people are that our party won't come together in the end. I've got the facts on my side. In 2016, a bunch of people voted for Democrats that maybe they didn't agree with. Maybe they were more liberal than the actual candidate. But they voted for the candidate because they knew at the core they were the right person and that it was the right thing to do for our country. So that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. So I hope you will support me, help us out. We are really excited about how we're doing it. We've just seen this sea change since the debates. After each and every debate, people get to know me, and they sign up with us. And then you can always call. I have 5 million job references. You can call anyone in Minnesota. They may not have voted for me, but they will probably tell you that I am honest, that I do my work, that I have people's back, and that I get things done. I passed the most bills as a lead Democrat of anyone on that stage, any member of Congress running for president right now. And I've done it through finding common ground in sort of the just very intuitive ways about where we can find agreement, even if I don't agree with them on most anything else. And that's what we're up to. So thank you. Remember, it's just a few weeks away, and I'm going to need help while I'm over there doing my job. Thanks, everybody.